Welcome. My name's Paul Yock. I want to welcome you on behalf of the BioDesign program. We had such a big audience this afternoon, we went to the Bishop Auditorium, and what obviously you'll see is people continue to walk in, so we're going to try to direct them to the back, but if you can allow people to come in, I'm sure we'll have a number of other folks drifting in over the next 10 minutes. So this is our wrap-up for the spring session, and we're finishing on a real crescendo. I won't introduce the speaker, David will do that, but it's going to be fun for the next hour. And for those of you who haven't been here before, the way we run this is that David does an interview for about 45, 50 minutes, something like that, and then we'll ask for questions from you. And I think in this room, rather than trying to get to this mic, if you just holler out your questions, that'll be, raise your hand and then holler out your questions, that'd be great. So a couple of other things to point out. First of all, we want to thank PricewaterhouseCoopers and Wilson Sonsini for sponsorship, and particularly Wendover for loaning us David. And those of you who have been here for previous sessions know that David does an absolutely wonderful job with these interviews. And the interviews often get written up in In Vivo magazine, so look for those there. One more really important thing. Please join me in turning your cell phones off, or at least to quiet. We do audio record this program. It will be available in a podcast through iPods. We'll get you information about that through the BioDesign emailing. And I think, David, anything else I'm supposed to say? All right, well, take it away.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks very much. I want to thank Paul and Sandy Miller and Mary Gorman, everybody associated with the Stanford BioDesign program. This continues to be, into, I don't know how many years we've been doing this, one of the most rewarding and fun things that I do on a regular basis. As I mentioned in the introduction to the last several speakers, the folks who graced this stage have tended to fit into one of a small number of select categories. We've done certainly our share of classic physician entrepreneurs, very strong technology-oriented folks, seasoned executives from big device companies, and more recently we've been profiling a group of what I've been calling the new generation of device executives. And tonight's guest, Steve McMillan, CEO of Stryker, we have someone who shares a bit of both of the last two, though he runs what is arguably the biggest orthopedist company in the world. Steve, as you can tell, is clearly one of the bright young executives in this industry. In addition, I think, as you'll find over the course of the next hour or so, there are several other interesting aspects to Steve's career, including a background in pharma, a focus on orthopedics, and one of the most interesting executive transition stories in the device industry. We also want to welcome all the Stryker executives. You can tell the Stryker executives are the ones in the ties here in Palo Alto, because I think no one else in Palo Alto wears ties. So, Steve?
They have to get them back by 10 o'clock
right,
tonight.
Exactly. Well, thanks for being here. I look forward to this. So, you grew up in New Jersey, which I think is a good state to grow up in. And your first job was at Procter & Gamble. How did you get to Procter & Gamble, and what did you do there?
Sure. I got to P&G. I appreciate the introduction. I don't want to let you down when you talk about bright young executives, because as soon as I open my mouth, it probably goes down. But I got away the job the way you never expect to get one, which is I wrote a letter to the human resources department at P&G and told them why they ought to hire me. And I was a silly little undergrad from Davidson College in North Carolina, and I still have the letter because I looked at it a few years ago and thought, wow, I can't believe I had the gumption to actually write why this big company should hire me. But in fact, they did. They hired me. My first interview was actually in the Port Authority in New York City. They weren't going to actually fly me up, but I interviewed at Lindy's Cheesecake in the Port Authority and took a couple of tests, and one thing led to another, and they ended up giving me the same job essentially that they offered to the Harvard MBAs, Stanford MBAs of the world, and I got to go in right from the start into a great program there.
So you were in brand management. What did that entail? Yeah.
It really required it. Brand management at Procter & Gamble is what they really call the center of the wheel. And you're in the marketing department, but you are the owner of any specific brand, whether it's Ivory Soap, Downy, you know, Tide, whatever it is. And in the marketing area, you then liaise with R&D, finance, manufacturing, sales, and particularly in the early days, one of your first key constituencies is learning the selling organization and really serving the selling organization. But you really get sort of the big picture that helped me learn how to really run a business, because I never took a business course in my life. But
and was there a specific brand that you had?
I started on Spick and Span, a real household name. Did such a great job that some of you may not remember it anymore. So, and then I worked on Mr. Clean, and also Ivory Soap were some of the key ones.
So soon after that, or how soon after that, did you move to Johnson & Johnson, which is, I think, your first, P&G has a healthcare business, but it was your first pure healthcare company. How did you get to Johnson & Johnson?
I got to Johnson & Johnson because they tried twice to recruit my wife. And I was the trailing spouse, honest to God, true story. But when my wife was coming out of business school, she was torn between P&G, J&J. She actually chose Procter & Gamble. So we were both there. A couple of years later, J&J came calling again for basically a package deal for both of us. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, made me a job offer in the McNeil Consumer Products Division. And I saw a young lady tonight who's with J&J's, that part of the business. So at that point in time, we decided to move back east. It was the right time in our life. And what I particularly saw in J&J, and I think it's something very much that we have going at Stryker, is at the time, J&J, was very decentralized, and it offered an opportunity for general management much earlier in your career. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to just being a cog, P&G gave a great foundation. But as you see, so many people end up leaving P&G and go run businesses elsewhere. J&J really gave me that chance, and that decentralized philosophy is something clearly that we carry through at Stryker as well, which I think creates so much opportunity for younger people.
Now, interesting enough, your wife did not go to Johnson & Johnson.
No, she agonized and ended up joining the Sara Lee company. So she was with Sara Lee for the 13 years I was at J&J. She was at Sara Lee.
So what did you do for McNeil Consumer Products? What were you responsible for?
I started out as a brand manager, and one of the areas was Imodium, which was essentially one of the first ever RX to OTC switches. Mm-hmm. And that really put J&J on the map as being kind of the prescription to over-the-counter switch, and was followed by many, many more, including Monistat and Pepcid and all kinds of things. I was the brand manager there, then became a group product manager over business development, which was licensing and acquisition and finding more new products, and then ultimately went over to Europe for 4 years and became part of J&J Merck, came back to the U.S. and then also back into J&J Merck. So it kind of bounced between wholesale J&J as well as the joint venture with Merck.
Now talk about the J&J Merck joint venture. I mean, I think particularly to folks in the device world, that kind of joint venture is not a well-known model. What was that joint venture all about, and is it a model that you've ever thought of importing into Stryker?
Yes and no. let's see. No, what it was about was really Merck was the best, in those days was, a great prescription company, and saw the opportunity in the future where some of their products would probably go over the counter. Now, candidly, I think they overestimated the number of products that would go over the counter, but they wanted to partner with the best OTC manufacturer, which really was Johnson & Johnson. So you had kind of the two world leaders came together, formed this joint venture, and it's the average life of a joint venture is about 4.5 years. That one actually is still going 18 years now after its formation, which is one of the very few. Having said that, it has not fully lived up to its expectations, and it certainly did not outside the U.S. I'm not a big fan of joint ventures because at the end of the day, what you really have, and I was often felt caught in between, you have two very strong companies, both of whom are used to getting their way. And so both of whom you end up making a lot of compromises, and neither side feels great. And I think for all of us who've been involved with partners, there's a time and a place to come together for technologies, but I believe generally with a shorter term, time frame or a clearer end point that somebody ultimately takes it over. The 50-50s are hard for the long run.
So you there's a kind of theme that runs through your career of managing new constituents that are handed to you. You were a J&J guy running a 50-50 joint venture. How did you do that? How did you get the Merck guys to buy on? Was there any counterpart at Merck who basically came in and rallied the troops when you were having trouble?
Not really. You know what? It was a lot about constituency building. And candidly, one of the things I probably learned in that job was how to manage up and out and around more than just down. Because I realized it was the first time that, you know, I've always been very focused on deliver the results and things take care of themselves. And I actually learned, frankly, the first time when I was in Europe, that a lot of the Merck people didn't like me very much and thought I was, you know, too much of a J&J person. And actually, I think when I moved out of the joint venture back to the States, there were a lot of people at Merck that kind of were happy to see me go. Having said that, then the European business started to do exceptionally well. And about a year and a half later, it was actually a lot of the Merck people that wanted me to come back in to be the president then of the joint venture on a global basis. So that brought me back. But it was candidly more politics than I enjoy. Mm-hmm. You know, what I've always been fortunate through my career, I think, at J&J is, you know, deliver results, focus on that, and things get noticed. And that was a huge part, frankly, ultimately, you know, that brought me to Stryker later on, because we're very much focused, try to keep the politics out, let the numbers speak for themselves. And I think that plays personally more to my strengths.
So you're actually Johnson & Johnson for a relatively long time,
11
years, particularly for someone who doesn't make a lifelong career of it. You didn't leave until 1999. What prompted your departure from J&J, and where did you go next?
Sure. I was actually house hunting in Pleasanton, California.
Because you were going to run the...
We were in the midst of actually moving out here to run J&J's LifeScan business. And we'd only been back from England for about 18 months. We were moving again. And while I was out here, I actually got a call from Fred Hassan. And those of you who may know Fred, Fred is one of the best regarded CEOs in the pharmaceutical world. At the time, he was really turning around Pharmacy and Upjohn. And they had no clear successor for Fred. And Fred called me up and just introduced himself to me on the phone, said, "You may not even know me." I did know him by reputation. And he said, "I've gotten your name and I want to talk to you." And I said, "I'm in the midst of moving. We're about to make an offer on a house." And he said, it was Wednesday. He said, "Can you meet me Friday morning when you get back?" And I sat down with him on Friday morning. I had no intention of leaving Johnson & Johnson. But he laid out a vision for what he was trying to do at Pharmacy and Upjohn and then Pharmacia. That was very exciting. And essentially also said, "Look, I'd like to groom you to be my successor to run the company." And you know, at that point in time, it was a couple of levels down in J&J versus, you know, somebody just reaching out and saying, "All right, you know, I'm going to groom you." And for 3.5 years, it was absolutely wonderful. He was a great mentor, continues to be a very good mentor to me. But at the end of the day, Pfizer came along and bought the company, so I was being groomed to run something that then disappeared. So it's, you know.
Any ill feelings at Johnson & Johnson when you told them you weren't going to take that job?
Yeah, at the time. When I first left J&J, it was not easy. But luckily, what was nice is over time, I've got a lot of strong relationships there. I care about the company immensely. And when Pharmacia got bought, I was actually, Bill Weldon, the current CEO of J&J, had reached out to me, and I was probably going to go back. I was planning on going back there until this man named John Brown called me up, and so I started to get to know him.
Well, actually, the first guy who's key was Bill Parfit. Who was Bill Parfit, and how did that connection come about?
Sure. Bill Parfit was on the board of Pharmacy and Upjohn of Pharmacia. Bill Parfit was one of the old former vice chairman of the Upjohn company.
And we should make one point here, which is that there's this little town in Michigan called Kalamazoo, Michigan,
yes,
which is actually a major healthcare center.
Absolutely. Between Upjohn, the former Upjohn company, now Pfizer, and also Stryker, and hopefully some other companies that are burgeoning on the scene now as well. But Bill Parfit was on the board of Pharmacia, had known the full game plan of what they were, you know, grooming me to be, and also had seen the results that the businesses I was responsible for had generated at Pharmacia. And he knew that I may not go to Pfizer, and, you know, he called up John Brown. I should say Bill is also on the board of Stryker. So you had essentially a board member that was on the board of both companies, knew me, knew John Brown, said, "Hey, John, you ought to go talk to this guy." And John proceeded to not do anything about it for a couple of months. It was one of those, you know, another one of these, you know, people that somebody on the board wants you to meet. But eventually he did call me, and we hooked up actually on one of his trips out east in New York City. I went up and met with John Brown, and it became a a full court press from John in a very short period of time.
Did you know Stryker or John at all before you got that telephone call?
If Bill Parfit had not, when Bill Parfit mentioned Stryker to me, the truth is I'd never heard of it. And because I wasn't in medical devices, you know, I knew very little about medical devices and I didn't know much about the company. I quickly got on the website before John called me the next day and tried to learn a little bit overnight. And what I realized is this is, you know, one of the great gems. And, you know, it's had a low profile, but just an enormously successful company. And one of the great platforms and foundations, I think, of any company going. And so I've learned a lot, and certainly as I met the team, got very excited for as great as a run Stryker has had. I really do believe the best days are still ahead of us.
Well, you know, for a guy who'd had intimate contact with Johnson & Johnson and Merck, one could make the argument that Stryker was kind of like the Merck of the device industry, to the extent that if you took polls year after year through the 80s and 90s of the most admired companies in the medical device world, Stryker would have scored at the top of, or nearly so, at the top of the list. What were your first couple of meetings with John Brown like?
The first meeting was actually at the Waldorf Astoria. He was staying there overnight. I went up and met with him, and it was a couple of hours, and a lot of it, frankly, was just him trying to get to know me, mm-hmm. my background, you know, what motivated me, and really as much as who I was as a person, and then tied in with what have some of the business accomplishments been, and but a lot of it, frankly, was what motivates me, what drives me, and from there, that was, I can tell you, that was on a Sunday, and I told him at that point I was about to go back to J&J. On Monday morning, he called me up, and he explained this whole Gallup process, which is something that we do, and we look at our people and profile our people to make sure they're Stryker fabric.
You know, G-A-L-L-O-P or
UP, Gallup, the organization. Polling. So yeah, P&G has their own tests for people, you know, different companies. And we've had a profiling system that works very well, and John wanted to do it to the very top. And that was Monday morning. He asked if somebody could fly out and meet with me and give me this interview. Mm-hmm. And that was on Tuesday. And Thursday of that week was the American Academy meeting in New Orleans. And so Tuesday afternoon he called, and he kind of would, he'd call every day, and he said, hey, can you come to New Orleans on Thursday? I'd like you to meet the management team. And actually I flew down Wednesday night, and that day in New Orleans met the rest of the senior management team, all the group presidents and everything, and it was a whirlwind of a day. But I came away and I got to walk the booth and, you know, pretend I was learning something about orthopedics. I was a little overwhelmed at the time, but it was just, it was such an incredible group of people.
What do you think appealed to Stryker about you, and flip it around, what made you decide, because Johnson & Johnson would have been a great place to go back, what made you decide to take the Stryker job?
Sure. I think what I saw, John over dinner one night said to me, look, you can go back to J&J, or you can build the next J&J. And when I thought about that, Stryker is today about where J&J was in the mid '80s, size-wise, and some of that stuff. And I still own every share of Johnson & Johnson stock that I ever got. I care about it immensely. Mm-hmm. I've got great friends. But the truth is, when I thought about the prospects, when I was at J&J, especially in the late '80s, early '90s, it was just go, exciting. You know, just growth and opportunity and all of that. And I thought, boy, if we could, you know, if I could catch that part of the wave again and help shape, you know, Stryker, who's going to be going through a lot of the same situations mm-hmm. that have kind of been there and done that. And I think that was part of the appeal from the board standpoint. They said, okay, here's somebody that has, you know, been with a company that's been decentralized, that's grown, that's faced a lot of the issues of, you know, through big growth and help lead it. And so I think it was really, it was that and the excitement, frankly, of being able to shape it and lead it and work with just a great group of people versus, and candidly having the chance to take over and run it fairly soon mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, J&J would have been, you know, A, there was no guarantee, and B, it would have been another 7 to 10 years until Bill Weldon stepped down. And, you know, I just thought, take a bird in the hand, and it's a pretty neat company, and mm-hmm. I think one that I could wake up each morning being that much more fired up about going to work with.
So you started as president and COO, and within a year and a half, you were the CEO, but there was a very conscious and purposeful three-year transition. Describe that transition for us.
Sure. It was a transition that John Brown and I hatched out over a little pancake place in Kalamazoo about a month or two before I started. I say we hashed it out. I think he had hashed it out. I think he had clearly had it all worked out in his mind and was just enrolling me to pretend that it was us coming together. But it really, I think, was a brilliant strategy. And what he came up with, it was, I started in June of 2003. And he said, we're going to call 2003 my year, which is effectively John Brown's year. 2004 will be Steve and John's year. And 2005 will be Steve's year. Mm-hmm. And what it did is it provided a continuity and a clarity externally, but also very much internally, that I think made the transition go, well, you know, here's a company where you have to think about it. You know, we had 17,000 employees that never knew another CEO.
Right.
Because he'd run it from 1977. We've never had really a CEO. We haven't had a CEO transition as a public company. And, you know, it was the investment community, you know, was particularly, frankly, a little freaked out when the company was going outside to bring somebody in. And what it gave is it gave time for us to establish, it gave time for me to learn the business, but it also set up meetings and clarification where he would be in. So, for example, in 2004, when we were planning for 2005, the budgeting exercise, even though he was still around, he wouldn't go to any of the meetings if they were about 2005. And so it started to provide this great clarity that I think was, you know, John's got a beautiful way of coming up with very clear answers and ideas. And it was a remarkable simplicity that I would tell you I would absolutely use, you know, someday when I hit that point myself to transition.
I will say he's an extraordinary guy. I mean, 30 years at a time when CEOs turn over on a regular basis.
Don't push it.
Here's a guy who ran it 30 years. So you talk about the difference.
Trying to get to 30 months right now.
Yeah. I think we're getting on 30 months back.
So yes, we are.
So there must have been, you talk about the different constituencies, there must have been a group of senior managers at Stryker, some of whom thought that he'd be next in line to succeed John. How did you break to them that an outsider was going to replace John? And what was their reaction to you initially?
You know what? Again, I would give all the credit here to John, that John orchestrated this thing beautifully. That, and candidly, I think John was such a legend and an icon that truthfully, I think there were people inside the company who were qualified but were actually scared to take it on. And I think actually themselves almost pulled themselves out of the running. Because, again, John had a certain way, and they'd never seen a CEO operate any other way than how John did it. And I think they basically concluded that they couldn't do it. They also were terrified of trying to keep the 20% going. For those of you who don't know, we've had 28 years of 20% earnings growth, and, you know, that's kind of a little bit scary to keep going. And so I think what he did is he worked with them beautifully that they were embracing it. And I met with each of them before I came on board. They were part of the interview process. And I think he wanted to make sure that it was unanimous with the senior leaders. And when you consider the magnitude and you consider the failure rate of, you know, COOs brought in from outside a company, last I checked, it's about a 70% failure rate. Mm-hmm. And into a company that has such a strong culture, John really worked it out beautifully. And then I worked very hard when I got in to try to win over the respect. You know, as I say to people, and I think one or two of them were at a meeting in Kalamazoo last week, you know, just because I had the title didn't mean I had the respect and the trust of the senior leadership team. So I think I kind of tried to work pretty hard to go earn that as well.
Well, what was your perception, or initial thoughts about the corporate culture at Stryker? And as you look to replace John, were you constantly trying to mold your style to follow and mirror his, or did you feel like you needed to send a completely different, be a different, completely different type of CEO?
It is such.
Why are you laughing about this?
It's a great question. It's one I spoke about with some of our employees last week, because I think I've finally gotten comfortable of recognizing it. It was a real struggle, because at the end of the day, I have enormous respect for John, but I am very different than him. And what was hard working under him for that year and a half particularly is I had a perception that he wanted me to be him. He wanted me to be a junior John Brown. And I think deep down, I think there's a part of that that he really did, but I'm also willing to say it's on my shoulders that maybe I thought that's what he wanted. And it was a lot of pressure because stylistically we're different. We get information differently. We interact with people differently. And I chafed. It was hard because I think I was almost being not myself. And I remember I had a discussion with one of the executive vice presidents after I'd been there about a year. And I suddenly realized that what had gotten me to the job, I didn't feel like I was behaving the same ways. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because I was trying to be a little bit something different. And at that point, I said, you know what? I just got to go back to being myself. It was a liberating moment for me. And ultimately, John and I talked about it. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, he said, you know what? I can't be you. If I say stuff the way you say it, you've earned credibility over 28 years. I can't say the stuff that you say without the people. You know, it may be a mutiny. I'll be voted off the island. You know, he's earned respect. And I think it was a cataclysmic moment where he also realized that, wait a minute, I do have to let Steve do stuff, you know, his way. And I think we've benefited from it.
I was going to ask, did you more often have to tell him to back off and let you step forward? Did you more often have to tell him, because you said before that some meetings, like it was 2005 budget, or did you more have to say to him, I need your support to help win over everybody here? Was it more a matter of keeping him from doing stuff that he'd been used to doing, or was it more saying, don't bail out on me yet because this isn't done?
You know what? A lot of that stuff, it wasn't that. It was more the stylistic than it was the substance, if I were to break it out. In terms of going to meetings or going to analyst meetings or whatever, we were remarkably well. And I would also tell you, in terms of business decisions, you know, I think what was amazing is that probably 95% of every discussion when I would put forward what I was recommending to do in a situation, we were dead on the same page. And so what was actually fun about it is the substance of how we think, our commitments to values and all those kinds of things, I think we're dead on. So I'd almost liken it to a marriage. You can be two different people, but if you have the same values, things work really well. But stylistically, it was just different. I mean, I coached my daughter's soccer team, which meant, you know, the two nights a week when I was in town, or I might get back from Japan and go straight to a soccer practice at 5:30 at night, mm-hmm. you know, he'd be in the office.
Yeah.
And it was those kind of things where he'd be in the office every Saturday and Sunday. You know, he doesn't have a computer. I carry, you know, a BlackBerry. So we get information in different ways. I don't have to physically be in the office. And I think, frankly, he missed that.
Yeah.
You know, why aren't you in the office every Saturday and Sunday? And that was a huge cultural shift. You know, people know, you know, to work at Stryker, you work hard, you love to win, you know, all that. But how we did it was different. So I'd say it was.
And knowing John, I mean, he went to work on Sundays because he worked every day. I mean, that was was his life.
The office is his living room.
Yeah, exactly.
He loves being in the office.
Yeah. And how much of it was an issue that here was this pharma guy coming in to run this device company?
You know what? Probably not as big a deal because I think if you really look at my background, you know, I was part of a pharmaceutical company, but I've had so many different businesses. I had animal health, I had a chemical business, I had, you know, consumer products, I had diagnostics actually in my pharmacy days, I had a plasma business. So I think I had learned a lot of that. And I think to me it was more about running global businesses and knowing how to figure out what needs to be done. So that part I think people were pretty good about internally. The orthopedic surgeon community, which you well know, is, you know, was probably a tougher test. Yeah. So as going out with our surgeon customers, you know, there was a lot I had to learn. So I spent a lot of time out in the operating rooms and, you know, trying to learn things, and I'm still trying to learn. It's been kind of an ongoing process in my life. But, you know, I'd say from a customer standpoint, it actually probably took more, more work to get fully accepted in that community.
Well, the reason I ask that is when Steve Oshley was here last time from Medtronic, he spent a long time talking about the differences between pharma world and the device world, and he's a device guy trying to kind of get into the pharma world.
Yep.
You obviously doing the exact process. He talked about things like product development timelines, the uncertainty of the development process, the cost development. What, to your mind, are the biggest differences between what you were used to in the pharma world and we've experienced at Stryker?
Sure. The what I actually love is the shorter cycle times in terms of product innovation. And that's frankly what I loved in my consumer products days. You know, my McNeil days, working on Tylenol, things like that. You know, you come up with an idea, you get it to market, you know, in less than 10 years. You know, in the pharmaceutical world, you know, and, you know, the pharmaceutical world and biotech, to a large degree, by the time, you know, you start on a product, and we've got our own OP1 that we've been working on for 21 years, you know, that's a little long, but, you know, in general, by the time you go through phase one, phase two, phase, you know, and bring products to market, it's a good 10-year life cycle. And even to make a change, you know, a formulation change or, you know, anything can be very difficult. So what I love being back to devices is, you know, if you have an idea, you can act on it a little bit quicker and get it going. The flip side is, I think the future of devices is getting more complicated, and there will be more of clinical needs and clinical studies that need to be executed upon. And I think that's where the pharmaceutical world has been far better steeped in knowing how to run good clinicals. And for example, as Stryker evolves from, you know, a hardware company and arthroscopic cameras and surgery and everything else, but also into the biotech world, which we are with our bone growth protein OP1, there's a different clinical set. And I think that's where, in a different investment time frame, different patients level and all of those things that mirror pharma. And I think ultimately what we've got to do as a company is figure out how to manage both. And I think we're well down that process now.
Well, we'll talk about that, because obviously that drug device convergence is a large part of Steve's vision and what he's trying to bring to Medtronic. Stryker has been one of the pioneers with OP1, but it's been a long time. When you look at drug device convergence opportunities, which you must actually at Stryker have a unique perspective on, given your background in pharma, do you think those kinds of convergence opportunities are going to be huge for Stryker, or do you think they'll be nice niche products but don't give up the hardware, the metal on metal and ceramic on ceramic stuff?
I think they'll be somewhere a little bit larger than niche, but not as transforming as people would have thought when, you know, drug-eluting stents came onto the market. And one of the key things that we've really been focused on is, you know, the obvious question we've gotten from the outside world is, if you have OP1, why don't you put it on all of your implants? Mm-hmm. And then you really have to come back to, you know, one of our big missions is, you know, to also help contain healthcare costs. And we could put OP1 on every implant, but I'm not sure the system needs it or could afford it. And so what we're really trying to do is figure out where are the right places to use OP1 both itself, and then what would be the right products to actually put it with. And in other cases, and you know, as you well see, you know, the chase to drug-eluting stents and everything else, you know, absolutely fascinating. But as some of the science comes out, you know, it's not as definitive anymore. And so we didn't want to just start, you know, getting on the convergence bandwagon. Frankly, we still have some basic blocking and tackling to bring OP1 to market itself and then be thinking about where we go. But we are certainly looking at the convergence. But I think it'll be more just incredible new innovations, even in hardware and in biologics independently. And then there will be some convergence. But I don't think it'll be the, you know, convergence will be the be-all and end-all.
I want to pick up on innovation in just a second, but your pharma background also brought another interesting perspective, and that is in consumer products and brand management. I've always been struck that when you go to a clinical congress like AOS or American Heart Association, if you walk down an aisle, well, you see your names like Stryker and Medtronic and Boston Scientific, and then Plavix and Celebrex and Zocor. The device guys have corporate branding, and the pharma guys tend to do product branding. I mean, you wouldn't know who does Plavix unless you got really into the booth and were standing around. What's your take on consumer marketing and branding in the device world? Is it appropriate? Is it behind where it could be?
You know, it's going to be a fine line. What I want to make sure that we don't go as an industry, and I've been very active, as you may know, with AdvaMed on this, is being careful that our industry doesn't go the same way Big Pharma went. What I find appalling is that the pharmaceutical industry, which truly does, you know, absolutely incredible things for this world, has such a poor reputation. And I think part of it was brought on by all the direct to consumer advertising. And I think they took it too far. So, and yet, in the world of the empowered patient, people want information. Mm-hmm. So where we're trying to go as a company is getting much stronger about what we call patient education. Mm-hmm. And we have more products, and you'll see more coming out later this year, that will have more of a direct education piece. But we're going to be doing more through the internet and through other ways, and occasionally some TV to encourage people to talk to their surgeons, as we have with Jack Nicklaus and, right, and the Ceramic on Ceramic Hip. And we've tried to build up the Stryker name into one kind of big umbrella name that people will go and trust. And then we probably will have some sub-brands start to become more prominent under it. But we want to be very careful because of the unique nature. And I think a huge distinction versus pharmaceuticals is our products are being implanted by a surgeon.
Right.
It's not just, okay, David, you want, you know, Lipitor or Zocor. You, okay, you're asking me for Zocor. I'll give you a Zocor script. You know, this is, if you're walking into a doctor and they've implanted 100 triathlon knees, which is, you know, the Stryker knee, and somebody asks for something different, there's an implication. The doctor could say, well, I could do that, but you're going to be better off with triathlon. Let me go with what. So we really want to be very careful. And I think that'll be a positive force for our industry to not go so far the way pharmaceuticals went.
What?
Is that me?
That's you, I think. Turn off your cell phone.
So where did it go?
Except yeah. You can keep so. Yours on.
Actually, that wasn't me.
That wasn't you. Okay, sorry. False alarm. You mentioned Jack Nicklaus, and Stryker actually has been one of the companies who've done direct to consumer marketing and advertising. And Jack Nicklaus is, everybody's probably seen these ads promoting that he's got a Stryker ceramic on ceramic hip. More recently, we've seen the gender knees, the knees designed for women.
The cartoony things?
The cartoony things by some of your, and others are picking up on as well. Do you think that that is a good thing? And it's interesting that one of the most conservative device segments, orthopedics, is doing more television advertising than cardiovascular or urogyno or...
I think it's an area we need to be careful of as an industry. And I think what I get particularly concerned about is, at the end of the day, orthopedic surgery is a life-changing surgery that is, you know, has about a 98% success rate. As you well know, it's probably the single most successful surgical outcome in terms of somebody gets a hip or a knee, you know, you've got, you know, essentially a 98% success rate. And we have to be careful that we don't, in the quest for companies to do well, that we don't over-market ourselves. And a couple of years ago, there was a lot of hype around the quote-unquote two-incision surgery. And a lot of patients started
minimally
to ask...
Minimally invasive.
Yeah, minimally invasive hip surgery. And a lot of patients started to ask for that. And it was only after a year or two that people started to realize there were much higher complication rates from that. And so what we have to be careful of, you know, to me as an industry, is making sure that, you know, we all want to get the leg up. Trust me, we're as competitive, you know us, we're as competitive as anybody. But we want to make sure we're doing it the right way. And I worry that some companies are on the verge and have been on the verge of going just a touch too far. And again, not wanting to see us get the backlash in Washington or among the consumers that people start to worry. So again, I think, you know, as long as it's focused on patient education and patient awareness, I think it'll be good. And I do think that there are some positives that will come from the advertising. And I, you know, just in general, which is one of the great growth drivers still of our industry, is that there's a lot of people that need hips and knees that are still putting them off, mm-hmm, because they don't realize the technological changes that have happened in the last 10 years. You know, my wife has a tennis partner who's just turning 50, and, you know, she said her tennis career is over because she went to an orthopedic surgeon, she needs a hip replaced, and he said, you know, what you ought to do is wait 5 years or so, and then, you know, we'll put something in because we don't want to put it into it. Well, the materials that we make today can essentially last a lifetime. And there's still a lot of orthopedic surgeons operating in the world of, you know, they're only going to last 10 years.
Yeah, so
put it off
avoid
as long
revision,
as you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet, in you know, with the baby boomer generation, we want to get back in the game. And so that's where I think a little bit of patient education done right will hopefully, you know, allow people to have better dialogues with their surgeons and be able to push and get the surgery that, frankly, they can have instead of being put on the sidelines for years.
So let's talk a little bit about the pace of innovation, because you're talking about new kinds of models. For cardiovascular companies, innovation and rapid iteration is a given. Steve pointed out 2/3 of Medtronic's revenues come from products introduced in the last 2 years, and a 22-month development cycle is pretty typical. But some people say that the one exception to that, and he's contrasting that with pharma, that the one exception in devices is orthopedics, where surgeons are very conservative, real innovation comes slowly, if at all. At this year's AOS meeting, one prominent inventing surgeon stood up and said that, you know, resurfacing is nice, ceramic on ceramic is nice, but this is an industry that hasn't seen a breakthrough in 20 years. What's your take on the pressure to innovate in the orthopedics? Do surgeons really want breakthrough technology?
You know, it's a great question in terms of where, what do you define as innovation? I would tell you different parts of our business respond differently. And in traditional hip and knee implants, you know what, back to the 98% success rate, those surgeries, you want to be careful first that you do no harm. And so what we are is we're continuing to improve on design, on materials, and it is incremental innovation. But the truth is, a knee put in today is very different than one 5 years ago, but it wasn't brought to the market in one fell swoop with the drug-eluting stent thing. But if you look at our triathlon knee, for example, you know, it came out, it's a totally different design. Then we brought a new polyethylene with it. All right, new polyethylene, big deal. It's a new plastic, you know, you put it under the... That new polyethylene reduces wear 97% from the previous generation. Now, the single biggest issue, if you're getting a hip or a knee, is the lifespan of the plastic that goes into your body. So, you know, is our X3 polyethylene a drug-eluting stent, a Cypher, a Taxus? No. Was it years in the making? You know what? Yes. And will it have a game-changing effect on the patient's life? Yes, because now we can put a knee in you that we can confidently say probably will last 30 years instead of the previous generation that would only last, you know, 10 or so. So there's that. The other part of our business that's also quite fascinating, and you talk about our group that's out here in San Jose, our endoscopy business. Mm-hmm. You know, we just launched the 1188 camera. It's a high-definition camera. There are product cycles are every 2 years. You know, if we don't have a new camera, new monitors, you know, so we've got certain parts of our business that are major upgrades every 2 years and less. But other parts where, while it may appear that it's not as breakthrough, there are, you know, the product being put in today is dramatically different than 5 or 10 years ago, despite the surgeons, you know, potentially saying, ah, there hasn't been a real breakthrough.
And in fairness, it's limiting to think of Stryker as exclusively an orthopedics company. You're a major surgical instrument company, a major bed company as well. One of the things that influences, I think, development in the device world is, and in orthopedics in particular, is something you alluded to before, which is the very, very close relationships with surgeons, customer intimacy issues. That's got to be different from the pharma world.
Very different.
And we're seeing now a great debate going on about conflict of interest and about the nature of relationship between surgeons and physicians. I realize that there are DOJ subpoenas out there, so you may be limited in what you can say, but some people put forth an argument that says it's appropriate to scrutinize the pharma industry because they don't have that same level of customer intimacy, and product development doesn't rest on...
Yeah, pick on them. Pick on them, absolutely.
But devices are different. Do you buy that argument?
Absolutely. And not just, you know... No, but it's... It is very... You made it so eloquently,
David.
I know.
I meant to leave it to you to
No, but it's very simple. Here's the issue. In a pharmaceutical product, you're going out and you're doing a clinical design, and I'm going to give you... Here. Take 10 milligrams of this product, every day for a month or whatever it might be, and let's see what happens. Our products are totally dependent on the surgeon that puts them in. And so you can't just give a product to somebody and say it's going to be fine. You know, if you look at the success rates of our products, I guarantee you, of this iterative process. You know, our triathlon knee, whatever it might be, our next generation hip designs, you know, all of the work in spine, they're all happening in a very interactive way with the surgeon community, because you're not doing studies on rats. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, you know, we've got to find out how these things work in real human beings. And every time we develop a new product, you know, invariably after a surgeon's been putting it in for a year or two, they have ideas as to how to tweak them. And therefore, I think what we then have to be careful with is there are certain surgeons who have genuinely very good ideas for how to improve products. And I think it's fair to compensate those surgeons via royalties or whatever it might be, you know, other ways to compensate them for the ideas that they bring to the party. You know, our engineers will design it, but it's just done in conjunction with them. What happened in our industry, and I think that the Department of Justice is looking at, is there are some companies who I think took that gray area and took it a little farther, which is, okay, Dr. Kasich, you're using our products, you know, we'd like your input, and we'll pay you, you know, here's $50,000 a year, we want to hear your input, but then, frankly, not really engage you on the input. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's that gray area that people stepped over the line. And I'll tell you, Stryker's always had a reputation as being a little tougher to do business with, because we're kind of prickly about making sure that if you have a consulting contract with us, you're really doing consulting and it's not a sham. And I think that's what will play out here. So, but I do think there's a very bona fide need. And I'm hopeful and trusting that the Department of Justice actually is figuring that out and understanding there are very legitimate differences between devices and pharmaceuticals because of that implantation element, whether it's cardiology, you know, whether it's orthopedics, you know, whether it's neurology, you know, that you can't get that experience any other way.
You know, we're running out of time here. This could go easily another hour. Let me ask a couple of questions, then we'll open it up
for
Q&A. And no, not at all. What role will M&A play in the future of Stryker going forward? And how much of that will be picking up small startup companies versus top-level consolidation? Before you got to Stryker, 1998 was a kind of watershed. J&J bought DePuy. Stryker bought Helmedica. Yeah. But the kind of wave of consolidation has never really kind of materialized. I mean, Zimmer bought CenterPulse a couple of years later. What do you see for M&A, both small and large scale, in orthopedics?
Sure. First off, let me clarify. We have no current plans to buy Pfizer. Okay.
So, you can probably afford them.
I think where things will evolve going forward is there will continue to be consolidation in the medical device industry, just as there, you know, will be in all the big getting bigger. You know, I think there's going to continue to be, you know, what I call the feeder fish. You know, a lot of the ideas coming in that will get gobbled up by the big companies. Having said that, the world of orthopedics itself, you know, there's three big players and there's two, you know, quite sizable players. The three big folks in orthopedics are really Johnson & Johnson, Zimmer, and Stryker. But then you've got Medtronic also in spine, and then you have, you know, Biomet, Smith & Nephew. I think back, you know, everybody says, okay, consolidate. I think if you actually go back to the surgeon relationship and the ability to engage enough surgeons, you know, and have them working legitimately on products, I think there's actually a point of diminishing returns. If one company gets so big, you almost can't keep all these designing surgeons engaged.
So you don't see a compelling argument for consolidation.
I don't see it, you know, and I would tell you that, you know, we've looked, you know, we clearly have the resources to have acquired either Smith & Nephew or Biomet. Mm-hmm. Biomet went private or is in the process of going private. Smith & Nephew tried to buy them. You know, those would be $10 billion acquisitions. We could clearly do that. but we frankly think we're on a great trajectory. I think where we're looking is additional technology plays that broaden us out and frankly, you know, continue to diversify our base. And ultimately, as we continue to, you know, we're in a very strong financial position right now to start to acquire companies that could essentially become new divisions.
Well, how far outside of ortho? I mean, obviously, you again, surgical instrument and a bed and stretcher business. But you said before that Stryker to you seemed an opportunity to be the next Johnson & Johnson. It was John's perspective. Could you see yourself buying into the cardiovascular space?
We are. We're looking at a lot of new spaces for us. I would tell you, cardiology is not one that I'm all excited to get into right now.
You know,
looking at the bloodbath of you know, the quote unquote.
I think you can buy Boston Scientific.
So we're thinking about that. Here, everybody pass in $20, and I think we could do that. You know, frankly, I'm not sure cardiology right now. That's an established base. To me, what's really exciting about med tech. Mm-hmm. is there are so many categories that are going to exist 10 years from now that mm-hmm. don't exist today, mm-hmm. that are going to obsolete either pharmaceutical products or are going to treat totally new indications. And some of those are exactly areas that we're looking at right now. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you, you know, you won't be describing us as an orthopedic company, you know, 5 to 7 years from now. We're about to go into the colonoscopy and GI market with our Sightline technology that we acquired from Israel last year. We are looking at a range of technology. You think about bariatric surgery. You think about the future of neurostimulation. There are so many fascinating technologies that to me, you know, one of the things I love about MedTech is it's a combination of high technology and improving people's lives. And, you know, Dr. Yock and I were talking about it earlier. It's just this wonderful thing that is going to continue to spawn new ideas, a lot of which we don't even know quite what they are, but we've got ideas on our radar screens right now.
So one of the legacies that John Brown left you was this extraordinary record of financial performance, 20% earnings growth per year. It's now your ball.
Oh, yes.
Is that legacy good because it imparts discipline and keeps people focused, or is it a headache you wish you'd never taken on?
It's both, and I think actually, if you talk to most of our employees, it's a real mixed bag. On the one hand, it's you know, very constricting and feels difficult, and on the other hand, it's very aspirational, and I think drives us and motivates us that to deliver that, you have to be the best. And for those of us who like to win, it drives us. You have to be better at innovating. You have to execute. You have to take care of your customers. You have to keep driving cost out of the system. And to me, the beautiful part about it for, you know, overall, I think about it almost on a relative basis as opposed to an absolute. Mm-hmm. You know, John says 20% forever. Forever for me might be longer than his forever right now. So, and the law of numbers gets scary. But what I would tell you is right now we've got a company that's absolutely delivering it. We're investing, you know, we're delivering that 20% while we've doubled our R&D spending just in the last 4 years. So I think it's doing a lot of good stuff. And what it does is it keeps us from getting complacent. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about the great companies that go down, to me, it's oftentimes because they start to believe their own press. I watched it happen to Merck. Merck was America's most admired company for 7 consecutive years. I used to walk in. I had an office there. I'd walk past the plaques, all 7 of them, lined up, and I watched the company change. They believed their own press, and they started. And energy level that I think is pretty unique.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been absolutely wonderful. We could, I think, talk for another 45 minutes. Steve, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts, and we'll open it up to questions and answers right now. Ted?
Great. Do we get to ask the questions and they give the answers?
Exactly.
No, it's going on. I'm sorry.
So the motto of Stryker is first be best, then be first. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. And I would tell you, that's not a full Stryker-wide. That's particular businesses that we have within the organization. So I would tell you that. But I think it's a very strong, and a number of our divisions really live by it, and it's to us it's a great motto, which is making sure we're doing the right thing as opposed to being on the bleeding edge. And it gets back to, we're in science, we're messing with people's lives. If I go back to the 2-incision surgery, it bothered us immensely that another company was out promoting this 2-incision surgery, knowing that the complication rates were there. But frankly, we were accused of having our head in the sand. We're okay having our head in the sand to know that we will prevail in the long run. And today, for example, our hip business isn't quite as strong as others. It's because we don't offer metal on metal implants, because we're a little concerned about the potential ionization in the bloodstream of metal on metal. And you know, there may be no issue, but we have not gotten comfortable enough with the science yet to be able to offer that. So, you know, we take great pride in trying to do stuff the right way. You know, I grew up in the J&J days of the Tylenol scares and had a great role model in Jim Burke, who did the right thing when Tylenol was tampered with both in 82 and 86. And I got to work with a lot of the people. I wasn't there, but I came in right after that. I worked with the people who always did the right thing.
Dave Collins. Do you know Dave Collins?
Dave Collins, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and you know, it was just a tremendous team. And I'm shaped by those values that J&J has and that John Brown and Stryker have always had as well. So we're not always first. When we come, watch out.
Let me ask one follow-on question to one that I was asking before, which is that one of the most interesting trends in devices has been the advent of private equity, and we're seeing that no greater place than in orthopedics. Blackstone took out Encore, okay. Warburg took out Tornier, and recently Biomet was taken out. From your perspective, is that a significant trend, or to your mind, does it really make no difference whether Biomet is owned by a bunch of public investors or a private equity group?
I think it's continuing to be the trend, just as is happening in all industries. You see Chrysler now getting taken out by Cerberus, and I think there's so much private equity money out there, we expect there's going to be more and more of that in our space. Frankly, what I think it will at least do from a positive standpoint is maintain rational competitors. You know, the private equity folks, I don't think, will behave stupidly, you know, after they've just put $10 billion of their own money into Biomet. And hopefully that will, you know, be a neutral to a positive. We were deep down hoping Smith and Nephew would buy Biomet and there'd be chaos.
Why did you buy Biomet?
You know what? We don't need it. It would slow our growth rate.
Really?
We're a faster growth company than either of those. We'd spend $10 billion and end up as a bigger company, but slower growth. And that's what happened in Big Pharma. Most of those mergers, I will argue, were about CEO ego.
Right.
They weren't about shareholder value creation.
Yeah. Well, certainly it's created very little shareholder value.
Yeah, you know, you look at Pfizer as the perfect example.
Yeah.
You know, they've destroyed $200 billion of shareholder value. Yeah. And I think, you know, Boston Scientific Guidant,
yeah,
you know, same thing. So it's why, you know, we're kind of more on the incremental innovation side.
There's one question right here.
As you know, one of the issues with decentralization are sometimes the organization boundaries that kind of limit communication and limit internal collaboration. So how does Stryker manage to optimize its transparency across the many entities that you have?
Oh, God, we're trying. It's not easy. You know what?
Is it important to do that? Or is there do you sacrifice it for...
It's actually one of the four key imperatives that we've been driving over the last few years. And one is innovation, but one is also leveraging across divisions. To us, it's about finding the right touch points and not forcing them, but really starting from a customer basis and figuring out where does it make sense for us to collaborate for the customer. And I think we've got pockets of where salespeople work together in a hospital across divisions and communicate well. We've got some R&D projects where platform technologies are going across divisions and working better at it. You know, I will tell you, there's no perfect model. You know, the problem, the way I look at it is, in a decentralized model, you have the challenge of communicating across. In a centralized model, you create this enormous bureaucracy that nothing moves. And I'd still rather have this one and kind of fight through some of the skirmishes. We have not mastered it by any stretch, but I think we're making great progress on it. No simple answer to it. It's very complex, as you know.
Let me ask one final question here, and then we have a reception outside. You are being groomed to succeed Fred Hassan And then you actually did succeed John Brown. And you're obviously too young to plan your next successor right now. But do you have any thoughts, reflections on how companies should plan for succession? Do you like internal versus external, competition versus targeting one guy? What you've gone through the process twice now. It's got to influence the way you are thinking about this.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm a strong believer, despite the fact that I wasn't internal necessarily. I'm a strong believer in internal succession planning. You know, I look at a Procter & Gamble and, frankly, a Johnson & Johnson. You know, to me, the great companies, the General Electrics, they've been able to do it from within. And I would personally consider it a failure if I didn't groom a successor. And we're already thinking about that, despite my age. So
at least the board is.
So yeah, that's right. Thank you for that vote of confidence. Were you at our shareholder meeting last
night?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to take my chair and go somewhere else. I do think it can get destructive when people are pitted more openly and publicly. You know, you look at GE, and at the end of the day, you know, the losers walked. And at Pfizer, you know, kind of a similar situation now where, you know, it's kind of blown up. And so I think you've got to be careful. And I think with enough lead time, you can groom a couple. And ideally, if they care enough about the company, then you can keep them, you know, but it all depends. You know, there's always going to be a certain ego that just has to run something. But I do think, you know, one of the things that I think we've been very, very pleased with at Stryker is that the whole senior leadership team is essentially still there and has survived the transition. That's been a kind of a pretty neat thing. And again, I think a testimony to, even though John went outside, how he managed it. And frankly, there was no internal winner and loser.
Right.
So that is one of the positives going outside. But culturally, it's hard to come into a company and get it and figure it out. And I would always rather bet on somebody that I've worked with over the years than on somebody who can look good in paper. It's always easy to fall in love with somebody, you know, when you first hire them and the first year everything looks good and then the warts don't start showing up until later.
Well, one of the things, it wasn't clear to the outside, but one of the things that John used to pride himself on about Stryker was that, I mean, he would go through these periodic just kind of shakeups internally to kind of clean things out. Is that something that you'll carry forward into Stryker, or would you like to just kind of create a kind of stable, static?
I like blowing the place up every 3 years, just whether it needs it or not. No, I'm a firm believer. If you think about the job that I'm trying to do, it's about evolutionary change. Mm-hmm. To me, I inherited a great company. And great companies can fall off the tracks in two ways, in my mind. One is failing to adapt, failing to change. And the other is changing too fast. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to do is evolutionarily change it. So we have changed out, you know, we've changed the head of the orthopedics division, the head of the spine division, the head of the biotech division, the head of our U.S. trauma business, the head of our CMF business, and we reorganized it. We have quietly put a lot of change in place, but no one, you know, kind of here's this year's corporate reorganization. So I think you'll continue that's what I would expect it to be, is a continued evolution, you know, and kind of constant change. But not, hopefully not, you know, ever needing to drop a bomb, you know, anywhere specifically.
Well, Steve, I say this all sincerity. John Brown was a great leader and couldn't have been easy following, but I think anybody who looks at Stryker thinks it's just in fabulous hands going forward. So thank you very much for joining us, thank you all for coming. And I think the reception is right outside to the left.
Great.
Thanks, that was good.
Thanks. That was fun.
That was great.
You know what, that was fun.
Yeah.
So it was a little...